previously on Fireline.
The word focus derives from the Latin word for fire, and it's a reminder that people love to focus on fire.
You know, I'll talk about it in a calm way because I'm a scientist and I'm trying to be as objective as I can, but this is me hitting the panic button.
We have to get past the promise that forestry made the world years and years ago, that we could control fire and put it out and regulate the forest in that way.
Remember, only you can prevent forest fires.
Fire is not some strange foreign creature. It is part of the soul of man.
Support for this program comes from Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Montana Properties, First Security Bank, Blackfoot Communications, and a New Angle podcast.
It's a cold morning in late fall, and I'm in the Rattlesnake, a popular recreation area near my house in Missoula, Montana. But today, I'm not hiking or biking. I'm walking among shoulder-high, pyramid-shaped piles of sticks, logs, and brush with Andy Bidwell, a fire manager with the Lolo National Forest. Andy's doing a prescribed burn, so he's getting ready to set some stuff on fire on purpose.
This is a drip torch. So this is just an ignition device that we use for hand ignition, meaning somebody just carries these around and drops some fire onto whatever we want to ignite.
It looks like somebody put a curly straw in a tank of diesel fuel.
Just minimal components, so they're pretty simple to use.
He walked me from one pile of snow-covered tree limbs to the next. Those limbs were left over from a forest thinning project and too small to process at a local mill.
And most firefighters carry some kind of ignition tool. It's a big lighter.
He crouched down, trying to find dry spots where the fire would take.
It doesn't take much to get them going, but we just want to make sure that they do get going and not walk away.
The scientific literature overwhelmingly shows that at a large scale, what Andy's doing can mean less intense fire seasons. Prescribed fires can get rid of underbrush that ladders flames up into the treetops. They can create fire breaks that slow down or stop big blazes. And there are other benefits too. Studies have shown that prescribed fire, coupled with thinning, is the best way to help forests hold on to more carbon that would otherwise be unleashed into the atmosphere by wildfires or large-scale logging. Prescribed fires could reduce fires' carbon emissions across the West by about 25%.
I think people are understanding that in these fire-prone forests that one of the main things we need to do as part of our active management is bring in more prescribed fire, reintroduce fire into these places.
That's Chris French, Deputy Chief of the National Forest System, in a U.S. Senate committee meeting last fall. Across the West, there are countless slash piles like these bundles in the Rattlesnake waiting to burn. But to make any kind of dent in the intensity of wildfires, we need to set fire to way, way more land than we've been able to in the past. We could devote a whole podcast series to the barriers to making this happen. Prescribed burns are often bundled with logging projects, so lawsuits can slow them down. People don't want smoke in the skies. Federal agencies need more staff and resources. And there are safety issues.
Hundreds of homes, thousands of acres.
Some burns in the past have gotten out of control and caused huge destructive wildfires.
This fire was deliberately set to help prevent other fires. What went wrong?
This is a news clip about the Cerro Grande fire in New Mexico in 2000. A prescribed burn went sideways. Hundreds of houses burnt down, and the flames threatened a nuclear weapons facility. Fires like this one can be devastating to the effort to put more fire on the ground. The point is, we need more burning, not less. But from 1998 to 2018, as we saw some of the worst wildfires on the books, the amount of prescribed fire we were putting on the land went down in the West. I'm Justin Angle, And this is Fireline, a series about what wildfire means for the West, our planet, and our way of life. Instead of zooming out to how we get more fire on the whole landscape, we're going to zoom way in and focus on one single story of bringing fire back to a place where it's been suppressed for decades. Some people and cultures have been intentionally setting fires for tradition, hunting and gathering, and the health of ecosystems for millennia. So why is it so hard to get fire back on the land? And what happens when we do? This is episode 4, The Gift of Fire. I met father and son, Tony Incasciola Jr. and Tony Incasciola Sr., in the height of fire season last year. We met in a lush, peaceful forest of widely spaced trees in the foothills of the rugged Mission Mountains on the Flathead Reservation, just north of Missoula. The reservation is home to the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. This is a tiny sliver of the tribe's ancestral land, more than 20 million acres in Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, and British Columbia. They've inhabited for at least 10,000 years.
You're going to say something first? No, you're going to start?
They wanted to interview you. I'm just along for the ride.
We'll just call these two Junior and Senior. They're both tribal members, and they took me to this particular forest to tell me about a big experiment here that shaped what the forest is today. Junior's the head of forestry for the tribes. He's wearing a trucker cap, a bright blue athletic t-shirt, and cargo pants, with a little burst of a goatee on his chin.
How did you get into this work?
Just as a kid. So I lived here, so this is what I do. I come to the woods all the time. I hunted, I fished, I gathered, I recreated, hiked.
Back when Junior was a kid, tromping around the woods, this forest looked a lot different than it does today. This spot is called the Jocko Prairie, named after the nearby Jocko River. But back then, the place looked more like a jungle than a prairie.
Very dense looking, very tight, slow growing, a lot of competition, ton of stems per acre.
This, a congested swath of ponderosa pine, is a forest type where fire suppression has played a major role in the buildup of fuel. Just like in the rest of the West, fire in this area was treated as an enemy for about a century. Without periodic flames, little baby trees and other undergrowth grew and spread, clogged the place up. To add to the mix, cattle were grazing through here.
You'd have to watch where you step, for one thing.
That's Senior. He has well-kept white hair and glasses, and a collection of pens in the chest pocket of his polo shirt. Junior grew up following his dad around the woods, watching and learning from him. And today, when Senior starts to talk about this place and what it means to the tribe, Junior mostly stands back and lets Senior lead.
You know, I had the opportunity and fortunate enough to be born and raised in a time period that probably the last part generation of elders that really understood the traditional values of who we are as a people, and also the last ones that actually lived that way.
For almost 5 decades, he's been working for the Culture Committee here to keep traditions and knowledge alive that could otherwise slip through the cracks.
I still learn something new every day from my elders, and it's something that education like that is a lifetime thing. It doesn't just come and go. You're not born, you go to school, you get a degree, and this and that, and it's over. No, education continues on and on.
Senior's education about fire started when he was a kid, looking up to his grandma. He remembers seeing the smoke in the mountains after a summer thunderstorm. She looked at that smoke and told him that it wasn't something to be feared, that soon there would be new growth and new life there.
She was adamant, a supporter of fires, knowing that she said the Creator is cleaning his room.
And it wasn't just fires off in the mountains.
We all have our favorite camping spots, our favorite hunting areas. Well, when I was growing up, it was no different. And in those areas, the first thing we'd do is get there. My grandma, who was the head in charge of camp, she would select an area. She said, we're going to camp. This is our camp. My dad and my brothers and I, first thing we would do was clear it and burn it.
Burning the land would prepare it for hunting and for harvesting.
You can kind of think about it as a garden. You know, a gardener out there taking care of his garden. You know, you got to weed it, you got to do things. Well, the bigger garden here is fire is used. That's the role of the fire. Comes in and cleans it out, and in some areas it needs help.
Looking back even farther, certain members of the tribe had a very special relationship with fire. They understood its behavior, how it would interact with upcoming rain or snow, and how it could rejuvenate the landscape.
They had what they called fire makers. In our language, they called them Sukpaham, which is a kind of a firebug fire maker. There were several of them that would study, would understand the environment, the growth, the different things. These people were the ones that set the fire. They knew when, they knew where, they knew the weather, and they were the ones that would set the fire.
He tells us more about that childhood camping spot. It was along a river in northwest Montana.
What is now the Flathead River. It used to be called the Ponderay River, which was after the Upper Kalispell people. The Ponderay are actually Kalispell, Kalispe, and in our language, Kalispe, which means people of the camas.
That plant, camas, is an important one to know. Camas is a flower that blooms bright purple in the summer. Traditionally, Salish women gathered and baked the bulbs of camas. One single woman might have gathered upwards of 4,000 pounds of the plant in a year. It was crucial for the survival of the tribe. But its use, and even its presence on the landscape, has plummeted since colonization. Here in the Jocko Prairie, let's rewind just 10 years, and the place is covered in cow patties. It's an overgrown jungle, a far cry from what it once was.
You know, our elders have always said that there was camas in this area, but nobody believed it because they couldn't see it.
Elders and others in the tribe took note of the damage to the ecosystem.
They said something has to be done. They can't go camping in their spots. They can't do recreate in their spots without stepping on some cow shit or drinking water anymore. They have to bring water because of that. That's when they started thinking about and started hammering our tribal leaders about what's necessary.
So what was necessary? Those elders wanted to breathe life back into this area, to get it back to that lush, wide open space. But doing so meant bringing fire back to the landscape. And that's no easy feat. We'll go back to junior and senior in a bit. But first, we need to understand how, for the tribe, fire had a very different meaning than it did for much of the rest of the country. When Jermaine White started thinking about those two different meanings.
I saw this extraordinary collision of cultures that occurred historically.
Jermaine's also an enrolled member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes, and she spent decades working for the tribes in cultural preservation. And she got thinking about the tribe's relationship with fire while working on a project about tribal place names, as in what areas are called.
They're oftentimes
names that come from coyote stories that tell about the making of places. So the creation of this landscape, they talk about resources that are on the land, or they talk about landforms. So this is some of the oldest memory of tribal people that our elders have carried from their ancestors and then have passed on to their children. What I saw at that time was that these places that the elders had known throughout their lives, so this is in the late 90s, these places that have been known for 12 or 14,000 years conservatively were changing within their lifetimes. There was development, infrastructure, there were roads, there was all kinds of change that had occurred. But how did the landscape change so profoundly?
As she talked to elders about how the land used to be, she started to realize that the cause of all that change wasn't just development. Fire had given the landscape some of the characteristics those names carried. Fire suppression was one of the forces that made things so different.
I began to understand the role of fire in shaping this cultural landscape that our elders knew and loved.
Now, this is one tribe's view of wildfire, and the federal government recognizes more than 500 tribes in the U.S. The specifics of tribal relationships with fire vary to some extent across the country. But before white settlers took over the land, it's fair to say that those relationships developed from living alongside and often utilizing wildfire. But as the U.S. government confronted tribes, it corralled Native people into reservations, killed them, forced them into boarding schools, and outlawed traditional ceremonies and practices. As this mission to suppress indigenous culture gained steam, very different ideas about fire took hold.
I also began learning about the early history of visitors and strangers that came to this landscape and how many of them came from Europe, from a Christian background and a built environment where fire was not considered a gift. You know, we can think about the fires of hell or the destruction of residential fire.
Germaine had written down a passage from an essay by ethnobotanist Nancy Turner.
And she said, quote, "It's ironic that the landscapes so appreciated by the early explorers and colonists actually were created by the very fires they feared and disliked." Well, that pretty much sums up the cultural collision that occurred when visitors and strangers came to this land where people were making fire, using fire as a powerful tool.
In the middle of the 20th century, as our national war against fire seized the country, so did an obsession with wilderness, areas we value for the natural beauty and lack of obvious human impact.
Congress was specific in defining what wilderness is. The act states
this is from a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service video about the Wilderness Act, which passed in 1964.
A wilderness, in contrast to those areas where man and his works dominate the landscape, is an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain.
Let me say that again.
Combined, the areas designated as wilderness in the U.S. are bigger than the state of California. In wilderness, you can't run a chainsaw, or drive a car, or build a road.
You can see the intent of the word untrammeled in the Wilderness Act. These are areas where humans do not direct what goes on in the environment. It is the forces of nature that affect the environment. The Act goes on to define wilderness.
This idea of wilderness, of land untouched by human hands, erases the long history of humans living in and shaping those ecosystems. As society waged a war on flames, fire, even if to make the land fertile and healthier, was forbidden. At times, the consequences for Native Americans were dire. Germaine tells me about a newspaper account from Missoula in 1875.
The beginning of November of that year, 183 lodges of Ponderay Indians were crossing the Rocky Mountains in the northwest corner of the territory. They were traveling east on a buffalo hunt when two of them were shot and killed by, quote, the officers of the International Line for setting a fire on the plains. So when people would leave in the late fall from, you know, and so this was at the beginning of November, when they were returning home, they would set fire that would make the, you know, that would leave an ash layer that was a fertile seed bed. It would, the next year, the grasses would be green. It was a way of restoring and maintaining the landscape. Pretty powerful disincentive to continue your cultural practices when you're shot and killed.
Germain, like Senior, sees the elimination of fire and what it means for the landscape as bound up with the elimination of culture and tribal people. In the absence of fire, native flora tribes relied upon for millennia have been overtaken and replaced by encroaching grasses, weeds, and other plants. In many cases, the knowledge and traditions that depend upon those plants and those ecosystems have withered away too.
It's easy to understand that when people arrived on this landscape, that it was a landscape that was shaped and maintained by fire, and that it was exquisitely beautiful. It's easy to understand that traditional knowledge of fire should be integrated into fire management practices today. But man, that's hard to achieve.
Back in the Jocko Prairie, Junior and Senior are showing us around.
We got a fairly large, 100 to 200-year-old ponderosa pine that's about 18 inches in diameter.
And with this fire, when we left off, tribal elders and others on the reservation had decided that this forest had gotten too unhealthy. It was overgrown from decades of excluding fire. Cattle were ranging through, trampling grasses. It made it hard to fish or hunt. Native plants like camas hadn't been seen there for decades. But how do you get from point A, this overgrown mess of a landscape, to point B, a healthy forest?
It wasn't easy, but after a period of time, they finally convinced, at the right time, some leaders that agreed and moved the cattle out.
So that's step one, getting the cattle out. But they still had to deal with the impacts of all that grazing and the lack of fire. And that meant, first off, thinning the area, coming through and cutting away some of that overgrown mess, especially the smaller trees in between the healthier, older, bigger ones. And then, at long last,
came through here in 2015, laid some fire underground, very low intensity.
So that thinning cleared the way for a prescribed burn. Before the treatment, if a fire came through the dense brush and medium-sized trees, it could have laddered up the flames into the canopy. Everything could have burned. But the flames Junior helped put on the ground burned the overgrowth and behaved more like a natural fire. It left the big trees standing and rejuvenated the soil for new growth. That was all part of the plan, but nobody expected what happened next.
And the next spring, we came back in here to do just a survey, and that's when we witnessed that this entire prairie was just purple, completely purple. All the camas came back. This place has such a high hydrological water table in here that we didn't even know. Obviously, we would think by the structure of the stand, it was a more dry, arid site, but it's got such a high water table in the springtime and then runs out and dries up more in the summer, which is perfect for camas. And so with that fire reintroduction finally back into it, it bloomed. I can't even guess how many years that camas was in here dormant. And with finally the exclusion of cattle from stop suppressing it, and then a rejuvenation of nutrients with the fire, it just sprouted. And it's come back every year.
That regrowth has slowed just a little bit. But that's because the work of burns like this one are never done. The area is on a plan to get burned again in a couple of years. That new fire will likely reignite the nutrients in the soil and keep the camas blooming.
There's been really a shift of recognition of us or native tribes nationally, regionally, using fire and seeing the benefits from it, for sure.
Early in this episode, I mentioned that prescribed burning in the West went down from 1998 to 2018. In that same time period, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was the only federal agency that saw its burning increase substantially. Organizations like the Indigenous Peoples Burning Network are also growing and helping amplify tribal knowledge around fire in Northern California, the Great Lakes, the Southwest, and elsewhere. Let's zoom out a bit further. Native Americans have a long history of taking part in some of the federal government's biggest fights, despite centuries of oppression. Senior himself is a Vietnam veteran.
So I felt that war, even though it took me, I still had that connection to the values of what, you know, why I am there. Not necessarily because of the fighting, but the protection of what I left behind.
Since the 1930s, indigenous people in the U.S. have played a significant role in the government's battle against wildfire, too. Tens of thousands of Native Americans and Alaska Natives helped build the country's trail and forest infrastructure. Today, there are 7 all-Native elite firefighting crews across the country. And in spite of all the deep cultural connections to fire, intentionally setting fire to reservation land still presents many challenges. Here in the Jocko Prairie, Junior explains.
There's still ways to go. There's still ways to go. Obviously, our forests aren't where we want them to be yet, and we're still striving to do that. We burn 3,000 to 5,000 acres a year. I mean, I'd love to see us burn 7 to 10, you know.
Burning that much more land on the reservation, or burning a bunch more land anywhere else in the country, means building relationships with communities in the area, who have to decide that having small amounts of smoke in the skies in certain times of the year beats out choking on smoke if a massive fire erupts. Junior says the tribe's forest management philosophy is based on using fire, not just suppressing it.
I see our forests coming back to a more natural state where burning will be more acceptable. But I think going forward, there is an opportunity someday to really let fire play more of its natural role.
It's just a matter of, I think, using our knowledge and our tools properly, and we'll get there. Our tools of knowledge are our tools of the gifts that were given to us, the fire, whatever, just learn how to use them, and we'll get there.
Senior used this language a lot, gifts. He says plants, animals, everything here is a gift to the earth, fire included. Junior sees it the same way.
It's not only a gift to us, but it's more of a gift to the land. You know, that's how I've always looked at it. It's a recognition that it's a gift to the land.
Junior says this open area could slow or even stop a raging fire. But fire resilience is just one small part of the bigger picture.
I mean, just speaking on Camas specifically, that practice and that gathering in here was absent for 100 years, I'd have to say. With the fire now, that practice can begin here. Cultural events can come back here. That teaching of that lost tradition in here can happen again. Not just with Camas, but when Camas comes back, other stuff comes back. It's not just one community, one plant. It's multiple things that start to happen. You know, as we open this stand up, elk come in more. And as that happens, hunting happens more. Gathering of Camas happens more. It's not just focusing on one goal. It's a goal of all the ecosystem here.
Senior has dedicated decades of his life to preserving culture on the Flathead Reservation.
Sometimes it's hard, you know, especially in this day and age. It's hard to keep those values and traditions alive because things have so changed. And that's because we all forget who we are, where we come from. Me, I feel I'm fortunate enough that when I grew up in a time period that I know who I am. I know where I come from. And I know what I need to do for the next generation.
Bringing fire back to this landscape is a part of that work.
You know, unfortunately, some of those elders that fought so hard for it weren't able to see the benefits of what happened to their work. And that's how we survive today. Those ancestors back then that fought so hard, they didn't benefit. What they were fighting for was not for them. It was for the generations that are here today. That's what life is about. It's not about me. It's not about you. It's about the next generation. That next generation depends on us, what we can do. I think this is a good example of the tribes. It's one of the tribal success stories, I guess, of what this country or what our Aboriginal territories used to look like. The fire creates safety. It creates new growth. It creates a lot of different things. It's not the fear that hundreds of thousands of years ago that worried people. It was making sure that that fire, you know, played its role. But today, there's a lot of fear, a lot of misunderstanding because it's simple, they don't know what the role is of a fire. You know, it's something that you will not be able to control. And you know, this country has tried to control everything.
Standing there with Junior and Senior, the sound of the creek and breeze blowing in the Ponderosa, I was struck by this idea. The control we try to exert over the natural world. In episode 2, historian Steve Pine talked about how the country's relationship with fire has long been one of control and domination.
We're going to knock fire out of the landscape. It was a crazy ambition.
Lots of scholars call the part of history we're in now the Anthropocene. That anthro, it means people. It's a time when humans have impacted every part of the ecosystem. Wherever you look, in forests, in rivers, you can't escape the legacy of us and our crazy ambition to control and shape the world. But to Senior, this forest and bringing fire back to it shows that a different relationship with the natural world is possible. One that's not based on control. One in which humans and nature shape each other.
It's things like that that people need to understand. You know, you can't control fire. That's part of who we are, part of nature, part of, you know, whatever it is that we see here.
I know that the physical and the mental demands of this job have gotten a lot harder.
After the last 3 years, the exposure to human suffering that we've seen in California, the Pacific Northwest, and other places. And so the stress becomes cumulative.
That's next time on Fireline.
Fireline is hosted by Justin Engel. Writing, editing, and production is by Nick Mott and me, Victor Ibáñez. Our fact-checking is by AJ Williams. Original theme music is by Travis Yost, with additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. And our cover art is by Jesse Stevenson. Additional support comes from Montana Public Radio, United Way of Missoula County, and The Trailhead. Narration recorded at Studio 49 at the University of Montana's College of Business. A special thanks to Andy Bidwell, Tony Incasciola Jr., Tony Incasciola Sr., Jermaine White, Peyton Adams, and Lauren Claremont. And a further thanks to the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes for sharing their stories and time spent on their lands.
If you like what you've heard, please follow us and leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts.